I decided to hit the road and see what else was out there. My life wasn't fulfilling. In fact, it was aggravating. I packed up and hit the road just to find myself, to find what I wanted to do.
The opinions expressed on the Rush Limbaugh program do not necessarily reflect those of WABC Radio or its management. And now, here's Rush Limbaugh.
For 2+ years, the Road Warrior, the Chevy Geo Spectrum with a turbocharged engine, was Tim McVeigh's real home. On the road, he was alone with his thoughts. But for 3 hours a day, he had Rush.
So happy you've joined us. It's a program exclusively tailored to rich Republicans and right-minded conservatives, liberals, Democrats, feminazis, and all that. Listen at their own risk, but we invite them to...
Rush Limbaugh was in his heyday. His show was carried on more than 500 radio stations, so from anywhere in the country, McVeigh could tune in. McVeigh was a Limbaugh superfan, a ditto head.
As they say, Rush is right, double meaning. And many people, opponents, consider his views extreme.
It's extremists that are Earth First. It's extremists that are in the animal rights movement. Extremists that are in a peace movement. Extremists are the ones that do need to be assaulted and attacked in a political sense. That's why I'm performing such a marvelous, worthwhile service.
Crisscrossing the country, McVeigh mainlined right-wing propaganda. He bought a shortwave radio and also became a devoted listener to the conspiracy theorist William Cooper.
What you're going to hear tonight is disturbing, very, very disturbing. You're all going to understand that you've missed some things that you should have understood right from day one, and you're going to be...
What also drove McVeigh was an obsession with gun rights. He journeyed from gun show to gun show across America, from Florida to Kansas to Ohio.
There's nothing in the Constitution or in the law that says you cannot own firearms. In fact, that right is protected, guaranteed under the second article, an amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America.
On the road, McVeigh made few connections, but he'd take long drives to visit old Army buddies, hundreds of miles up Interstate 69 to Terry Nichols in Michigan. Rush helped McVeigh sift through the noise in his head.
As I've always said, you don't need to read the papers, you don't need to do it anymore, I'll do it for you, plus I'll tell you what to think.
Over 2,000 miles southwest, I-94 to I-80 to I-40, he'd arrive in the desert to visit Michael Fortier in Kingman, Arizona. McVeigh claimed that he could drive for 3 straight days and nights without falling asleep at the wheel. He'd force himself to stay awake as talk radio raged against those deep state quiche-eating elites.
No. That vegetarians are now becoming militant and they are defining ethics and morality by what you eat. You're immoral and you have no ethics if you eat beef. And we know that...
McVeigh's own diet consisted mostly of fast food, which messed with his digestion. So he would pop Rolaids and chug Pepto-Bismol in the car. Fueling the momentum, there was always a new outrage on the radio.
Well, I don't know if Randy Weaver knew that the shotgun was too short. And so far, nobody else does either, because the federal government sealed all the evidence. Nobody can find out anything. It's Soviet-style justice in the United States of America.
Immigration, socialized medicine, income taxes, they all enraged McVeigh. But it was the siege at a cult compound in Texas that whipped him into an uncontrollable frenzy.
You're going to learn tonight that every single firearm that those people possessed down there in Waco, Texas, were under siege by the Nazi stormtroopers of the socialist totalitarian New World Order. All of their weapons are legal. Legal.
Inside the Road Warrior, McVeigh's frustrations, failures, and anger boiled over, and he became determined to strike back. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and this is Homegrown. Episode 3, First Blood.
Yeah. And now, to honor America, especially the brave men and women serving our nation in the Persian Gulf and throughout the world, please join in the singing of our national anthem.
Super Bowl 25, the New York Giants versus the Buffalo Bills.
The anthem will be followed by a flyover of F-16 jets from the 56th Tactical Training Wing at MacDill Air Force Base.
It's January 1991, an especially patriotic time in America. The game starts with that famous performance by Whitney Houston of the national anthem. As the Super Bowl kicks off, we're only 11 days into the first Gulf War. Tim McVay was a huge Bills fan. As a kid, he endured the frigid Buffalo winters to root for his hometown team. But for the Super Bowl, McVay was fighting Iraqis in the desert, and he missed the big game.
There's a snap. There's a kick. It is up. It is no good. No one missed. 4 seconds left. The Giants have won Super Bowl 25.
The Bills lost by a single point, the narrowest margin in Super Bowl history. Grown men in Buffalo wept. From the war zone in the Gulf, McVay wrote to his grandfather,
"I heard the Bills lost the Super Bowl. Ruined my whole week."
Private John Kelso.
You know, he had Bills hooded sweatshirt, had Bills, you know, sweatshirts, he had Bills t-shirts. He was a, you know, a diehard Bills fan.
After Kelso and McVay returned from Desert Storm, they lived together for a short time outside Fort Riley.
That was probably the one thing I probably seen that he always was happy about. You know, he liked to talk about the Bills. But that was, other than guns and the Buffalo Bills and maybe his sister and dad, that was it.
As with his own failures, McVay blamed the Bills' loss on a rigged system.
Of course, you know, the NFL was unfair to them, or, you know, that there was a reason that the Bills continued to lose. The referees were against the Bills ever winning it.
By the end of 1991, after failing in his dream to join the Special Forces, McVay was 23 years old, out of the Army, and living in his dad's house. His fandom for the Bills was one of the few positive things that McVay could tap back into.
And while the Bills fell short in their first Super Bowl this season, this team will be a team to be reckoned with in the 90s. They are still young.
McVay was making a decent salary as a security guard supervisor, and he started betting heavily with a bookie on his beloved Bills. In 1992, his team amazingly made the Super Bowl again, and McVay thought there was no way they could lose this time. He put down $1,000.
The Redskins are the world champion.
Again, the Bills lost.
Once again, the final score of Super Bowl 26 is Washington 37, Buffalo 24. Stay tuned for the Super Bowl today.
At about the same time, the Army demanded that McVay return, with interest, his $3,000 reenlistment bonus because he hadn't completed his commitment. McVay's finances were a shambles.
He had all these Medal of Honor and commendations. He was an exemplary soldier. And when he got out, he didn't really have a purpose anymore.
Gerilyn Merritt is an attorney who served on McVay's defense team after Oklahoma City.
So he was in this quagmire where he had lost everything and failed at something that was especially critical to him. And he casting around for someone to blame, laid the blame on the federal government.
McVay started writing a torrent of letters, many to friends, but also to his congressman and the local newspaper, the Lockport Union Sun and Journal. These are McVay's words read by an actor.
What is it going to take to open up the eyes of our elected officials? America is in serious decline. We have no proverbial tea to dump. Should we instead sink a ship full of Japanese imports? Is a civil war imminent? Do we have to shed blood to reform the current system? I hope it doesn't come to that, but it might.
I hope it doesn't come to that, but it might. In June of 1992, a restless McVay hopped into the Road Warrior. Right-wing radio reinforced his rage that the country was heading in the wrong direction.
The point they're trying to make is, see, this is how uncaring America is. This is how insensitive America is. These people are dying. Look at them. We can show you their ashes, right? This is nothing but exploitation of the homeless folks. Designed to make you feel guilty. Designed to attack the great systems of America which allow the greatest prosperity in the world.
McVeigh journeyed to the Thumb of Michigan to visit his old army buddy, Terry Nichols.
This was the first time I had visited him since I'd been out of the service. I had to ask a farmer for directions on where the hell this place was.
McVeigh drove past silos and sprawling cornfields until he arrived at a two-story white farmhouse just outside the small town of Decker. The two friends hadn't been in close touch since Terry left the army, but McVeigh was welcomed with open arms to the Nichols family farm.
Many people would say that the two of them are an odd couple. They really are. McVeigh is 13 years younger than Nichols.
Larry Mackey was a federal prosecutor who worked on the trials of both McVeigh and Terry Nichols.
McVeigh looked and dressed and acted a lot sort of close to a skinhead, while on the other side, Terry Nichols looked like your everyday insurance salesman.
The house in Decker was good-sized, with five bedrooms, plenty of space for McVeigh to stay. Terry lived there with his brother James. Their mother, Joyce, had bought the 160-acre property just as the farm crisis of the 1980s hit. And the Nichols brothers found explanations for their financial woes in right-wing conspiracy theories.
They believed in their own mind that the federal government was being oppressive. Nichols, for example, I would just put him more in the classic tax protester camp.
Nichols introduced McVeigh to his new wife, a young woman named Marife Torres. Terry connected with Marife through a mail-order bride operation in the Philippines. When they met, Nichols was 35. Torres was 16. Nichols was also broke. He had run up about $60,000 in charges on various credit cards, and he used the incoherent language of the movement to try to excuse his debts.
When Nichols got in trouble, for example, on not paying his debts back home in Michigan, he would show up at hearings and refuse to be recognized by the judge, saying, I'm a, quote, sovereign citizen.
Terms like sovereign citizen and common law individual were used by right-wing extremists in those days based on a crackpot view of the Constitution.
Now, they usually, like arguments that the 16th Amendment, which authorized income taxes, was never truly appropriately ratified. So that gives them some, quote, good faith basis not to pay their taxes.
The highlight of McVeigh's trip was meeting Terry's older brother, James, who was actually more politically outspoken.
Did Timothy McVeigh ever stay here?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. He stayed here several times for the longest period, about 3 months or so, I don't know. But he was a nice guy.
Decent guy?
Oh, yeah.
In 2002, James Nichols was interviewed by Michael Moore in the gun violence documentary Bowling for Columbine. James is talking here about the raid on the family farm after the Oklahoma City bombing.
Them people, law enforcement, if you want to call them that, were here and they were shaking in their shoes. They were physically shaking, scared to death.
Of?
Because they thought this was gonna be another Waco. Because certain people, namely my ex-wife and other people, said, I'm a radical, I'm a wild man. I got a gun under every arm, down every leg, in every shoe, every corner of the house. You say anything to me, I'll shoot you.
James Nichols became a kind of ideological tutor to McVeigh. In the first of many trips to Decker, James introduced McVeigh to the far-right magazine, The Spotlight. Typical headlines ran along the lines of, Citizens Fight Forced Fluoridation, U.S. Sovereignty Passed to UN, Beware Global Police. A consuming obsession was the threat of gun control, with articles headlined, Take Gun Grabbers Seriously, and New Attempts to Grab Your Gun. James also introduced McVeigh to ideas from the infant Michigan militia. Neither James nor Terry nor McVeigh himself ever formally joined what would become one of the biggest militias in the nation, but they shared most of the group's methods and agenda.
I remember James had a couple of videotapes of meetings that he had been to. Basically, when I watched these tapes, it was one guy standing up and getting on his soapbox and telling his story and then saying what he thinks is right and wrong.
After leaving Decker, McVeigh mailed away for official membership in the Ku Klux Klan, which was then headquartered in Arkansas. Then, disaster.
With high hopes and brave hearts, in massive numbers, the American people have voted to make a new beginning.
On November 3, 1992, Bill Clinton was elected President of the United States. McVeigh was no fan of George H.W. Bush, but Clinton seemed far worse. As 1992 drew to a close, nothing seemed to be going right. McVeigh's letters to the editor, to the congressman, to his friends, all felt pointless.
I looked back through history and started studying literature I was getting from Shortwave and Spotlight. And for a century, people had been fooling themselves into seeing that a vote will help or writing letters will help.
In January 1993, the Buffalo Bills played in their third straight Super Bowl.
To see if it'll be Buffalo Bills trying to deny that three losses in a row, or will the young Dallas Cowboys...
McVeigh repeated his bet of $1,000, and the Bills lost yet again.
I wonder what effect losing for the third time has on the near future of this franchise.
Something to ponder.
McVeigh was broke, despondent, and disgusted. He decided that the time had come to settle his affairs in Buffalo. He quit his job, paid off his bookie, and started to disengage from the conventions of middle-class life. Taking inspiration from Terry Nichols, McVeigh walked out on about $10,000 in credit card debt, and he used some of the money to buy gold. As 1993 began, McVeigh had $6,000 in gold bars, $3,000 in cash, and $6,000 in guns and ammunition. He sold almost everything else and kept only what would fit in the Road Warrior.
You have heard me inform you about the trouble this country is in, both politically and financially, and the time to act is now.
In figuring out what to do next, McVeigh returned to his first love, guns.
Well, guns were his whole life. I mean, I think that was his first love, then probably the military, then maybe the Bills.
John Kelso, the old Army buddy, remembers that back at Fort Riley, McVeigh would sell guns to fellow soldiers.
Behind the barracks, out of that Geo Spectrum car, or whatever that Chevy car is, he was selling guns to guys out there at lunch, the people that were supposed to be policing and not allowing this shit to happen.
While they were still in the Army, McVeigh took Kelso on a little trip in the Road Warrior.
He drove 90, 100 mile an hour where we went. I've probably been in his car 25, 30 times. And, you know, any crevice had a gun in it.
They arrived at a gun show in Topeka. Kelso was a hunter, and he was happy to tag along for what he thought was going to be a quick stop.
I'm thinking it's going to be 30, 40 minute transaction. I'm going to go in and walk through real quick, see if they have... So I was looking for some duck decoys and something else. And I don't know if you've ever been to a gun show, but it's like a freak show. I think we got there around 10 a.m. And instead of Tim walking through, you know, looking for the gun, he stopped at every booth. And there were hundreds of booths. He stopped and dug through boxes, looked at books they had for sale, and guns, ammunition, and he done that to every one of these. I sat in the car and slept a couple hours and then came back in, and he wasn't even halfway through.
Kelso says that McVeigh wandered around the gun show for more than 6 hours, and it seemed like he knew a lot of people there.
You know, if there was probably 400 or 500 vendors in there, he probably knew 60 or 70 of them. These were his people. They didn't judge. They didn't, you know, all they're trying to do is peddle their shit. And they weren't there to judge you. If you had cash, you know, that's what they were after. And I think he loved the gun shows and the gun people probably more than the Buffalo Bills. And that's, I don't say that easily. It was like the Mecca for him. It was, you could kind of tell if he hadn't been in the military, this would be his life.
A while after he left the military, McVeigh did try to make gun shows his life. In January 1993, he drove 1,400 miles from Buffalo to Florida to stay near his sister. McVeigh set up a small booth at a gun show in Fort Lauderdale. McVeigh drew attention because he showed up in army fatigues. He still had his crew cut, polished boots, and military bearing. He would tell anyone who asked that he was a Desert Storm veteran, which was still a novelty at the time. McVeigh had a vague plan to try to make a living at gun shows. He wrote to a friend,
"I'm trying to recoup some of my Super Bowl bet losses."
It became a source of revenue for him, so he lived on the gun show circuit for about 18 months.
Stuart Wright is a sociology professor at Lamar University in Texas, where he specializes in studying religion and violence. Wright was called as an expert witness by McVeigh's defense at trial.
So it kept him in some ways sort of out of sight and off the main roads and a little bit under the radar for police and enforcement.
At McVeigh's booth, his limited inventory included a little bit of ammunition, canteens, duffel bags, T-shirts, bumper stickers, and a big stack of the Turner Diaries.
The gun show circuit had become a radicalized subculture where people could obtain various anti-government literature.
Stuart Wright went to gun shows in the 90s, and he says that the presence of a violent and racist novel was pretty typical.
Here's a random list of titles that I saw on the gun show circuit. A Call to Arms, Battle Preparations Now, Citizen Soldier, Equipping for the New World Order, Improvised Weapons of the American Underground, Operation Vampire Killer, Toward a Police State, ? The Ultimate Sniper, Unconventional Warfare Devices and Techniques, and the Vigilante Handbook.
At the gun shows, the literature and the conversation all revolved around a federal government coming to take your guns.
And so you could see how this was getting written up and the narrative was being constructed by the far right.
In fact, after a series of mass shootings in the late 80s, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had been cracking down, sometimes aggressively, on assault weapons like Uzis and AK-47s, which were illegal at the time.
I'll never forget that terrible day, November 9th, 1989. They knocked on my door at 5 in the morning. I was completely unsuspecting as I got up to see who it was.
The plot of the Turner Diaries, with its gun-grabbing, white man-oppressing federal government, resonated with the radicalizing gun movement. That's why McVeigh sold the book, and that's why people at the gun shows bought it.
Maybe we should be heartened by the fact that there were still so many of us who had guns then, nearly 18 months after the COIN Act had outlawed all private ownership of firearms in the United States.
For McVeigh, the Turner Diaries soon became real, with a news event in Texas that would completely change his life. On February 28, 1993, federal agents stormed the compound of the Branch Davidians, a messianic offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventists. The church was led by a man named David Koresh. Rumors that he had accumulated a stash of illegal weapons led to a search warrant. Then things went south.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us. A fanatical, scripture-quoting religious leader who moved to Waco to await the end of the world instead may be to blame tonight for the deaths of several federal agents.
Four federal agents and five Branch Davidians were killed during a 2.5-hour gun battle.
We've got a standoff that continues at this hour after two shootouts earlier today at a compound located 10 miles east of Waco in the community of Elk.
Yeah, Bob and Minerva, never before has the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau lost this many people in a single operation, and the government was prepared for trouble this morning.
David Koresh refused to surrender, and the FBI was brought in to try to bring him out. A siege and a national news phenomenon began.
And good evening, friends. Right now, we just don't know. Despite his pledge to surrender over 7 hours ago, still no break reported tonight outside of Waco. Cult leader David Koresh apparently remained.
That was just a few hours
down the road from Dallas. And I was excited to report on this because it was not only national, but international news.
When the standoff started, Michelle Rauch was a 22-year-old journalism student at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Rauch approached the faculty advisor at her student newspaper to ask for permission to go to Waco.
And he initially said no because I was a student and I could not be excused from classes to go do this story off campus. Well, as we all know, that standoff lasted weeks and weeks. And during spring break, I decided I'm just going to go down there and find a story.
Michelle and a friend drove toward the compound. Just before they reached the law enforcement roadblock, Michelle noticed a handful of people on a small hilltop.
I immediately said, "Stop the car. My story's on that hill." So we pulled over on the shoulder, walked across the highway, went up on that hill, and it was a really interesting gathering of people.
Rauch found one man handing out Seventh-day Adventist pamphlets because he didn't want his religion to be confused with the Branch Davidians. She found a tent with a husband and wife selling T-shirts with concerns for the children who were still inside the Waco compound.
And then next to them was a man who was all by himself sitting on the hood of his car.
That man was Timothy McVeigh, sitting on top of the Road Warrior. McVeigh had watched a lot of news coverage about Waco.
"I saw the guys climbing on the roof and falling down, and I remember turning to my sister, and she said something like, 'Oh, that's terrible.' And I said, 'Well, okay, they're killing feds. They must be doing something right.'"
Incensed by the news, McVeigh took a break from the gun show circuit. He decided to drive the 1,300 miles from Florida to see for himself what was going on in Texas.
He was a very unassuming guy, really kind of looked like your all-American guy, very articulate. He came across as intelligent.
McVeigh explained to Rauch that he was out there to make a statement. A hand-lettered sign advertised bumper stickers for $1.50 apiece. The stickers were splayed out on the hood of the Road Warrior. They said things like, "A man without a gun is not a citizen."
"Fear the government that fears your gun is one. Ban guns. Make the street safe for a government takeover."
As McVeigh saw it, the only crime that David Koresh had committed was owning guns. McVeigh had a lot to say to Rauch. He made up the bulk of the story she wound up writing for the college newspaper.
He also said, and this was a direct quote,
"The government is afraid of guns people have because they have to have control of the people at all times. Once you take away the guns, you can do anything to the people."
He believed that the government was greatly at fault in Waco and broke constitutional laws. And he quoted the U.S. Constitution and said U.S. armed forces should not be used against civilians, but yet they were used against Koresh and his followers.
"I believe we are slowly turning into a socialist government. The government is continually growing bigger and more powerful, and the people need to prepare to defend themselves against government control."
He said that the Koresh standoff is only the beginning and that people should watch the government's role and heed any warning signs.
McVeigh's comments to Rauch represented an almost perfect distillation of his political philosophy. He regarded guns as instruments of freedom, and any attempt to regulate them, especially by the federal government, as a form of oppression. The FBI officials in charge of the Waco siege didn't have a lot of good options. The Davidians had 360-degree vision around their compound. They could easily respond to any direct attacks. Individuals who had been released earlier said there were dozens of children inside. As one leading FBI official put it, the situation was, quote, "a shit sandwich." From the hilltop, McVeigh watched in dismay as the feds built up their forces. He saw the government was using the kind of military equipment he knew very well. Bradley fighting vehicles.
"Texas, we have been watching as they have sent vehicles in to ram holes in the compound and send tear gas in."
Sociology professor Stuart Wright again.
He recognized the tanks that rolled in as tanks that he manned during Desert Storm. And he even said to his comrade, Terry Nichols, he said, these people are going to die. This is all going to end badly. And from that point on, he was really, really angry.
McVeigh hopped back into the Road Warrior and drifted around the country for about a month, accompanied by right-wing radio, fuming about Waco.
You see, all that they've heard is what the government has presented to them. We have discovered that most, if not all, of what the government is telling us about Waco, Texas, is a lie.
After visiting a gun show in Oklahoma, McVeigh arrived back at the Nichols family farm in Michigan. He was still seething over Waco, and so were Terry and James.
Our anger increased every time we heard something on the news. Like, well, the federal government decided to employ psychological warfare today. They're blasting sound at these people's house. There are women and children there. They are keeping the lights on all night. They won't allow communication with the outside world. It's common sense, at least to me it was, that when you look at their place, it's their home. They didn't ask these agents to come out to their home. Nothing could stop the federal juggernaut from taking these people in custody.
Tim and Terry chose to make a stand.
Me and Terry decided to go down there and maybe hook up with other people that may be down there. We had no way of knowing, but any action is better than no action.
The following morning, McVeigh was changing the oil on the Road Warrior in preparation for another long drive, this time a return to Waco. Suddenly, Terry rushed out of the house and screamed for McVeigh to come inside and see what was on television. It was April 19th, 1993. In Waco, after a 51-day standoff, the FBI grew impatient. They used tanks and tear gas to force the issue.
We're going to take you back live to near Waco right now. The cult compound there about 1 hour ago went up in flames.
At 12:09 p.m., there were the first signs of flames inside the compound. In just 2 minutes, the fire, whipped by high winds, consumed the entire building.
Well, as you can see, the parts of the building have collapsed. The fire has indeed engulfed the vast majority of this compound that has been the site.
Bonnie, the entire roof is gone.
The entire roof is gone. Mike, what else can you tell us? Any sign of firefighting equipment?
I know. No, none whatsoever. And
by the time the first firefighting units arrived at 12:41, the compound had burned to the ground. 76 bodies, including those of 25 children, were found in the wreckage. There were no survivors.
The flames may be out, but a firestorm of controversy rages on after the assault on the Branch Davidian compound. Officials are starting to look for answers after doomsday in Waco.
I was changing my oil in my car, getting ready for the trip, when it came on the radio. The place was burning down.
On April 19, 1993, McVeigh was at the Nichols farm in Michigan, preparing to return to his vigil at Waco.
And I remember tears came into my eyes, and someone came out of the house and said, "They've got it on TV. Come in here, Tim." And I ran in, and she's burning, and no one is doing anything. There's no fire equipment. They're just standing there, watching it burn.
The Davidians' flag had flown over the compound throughout the siege. Not long after the fire started, McVeigh watched as the flag broke away and flew off into the wind.
Sure enough, the ATF goes in and raises their flag over the ruins. Great. There are a bunch of charred babies laying there, and you raised your flag. You conquered a lot, buddy. So this just pretty much hammered me down that I was going to do whatever I could to wake people up and help people fight, because this is wrong.
Yesterday, as the 51-day siege at the Branch Davidian compound came to its infernal conclusion, the city stopped and watched and was silent.
He decides to avenge the death of what are to him ordinary citizens.
McVeigh's lead attorney, Stephen Jones.
It's one of my most lasting memories of conversations with him when he really got into it emotionally and factually and how he felt about it. He said, when I saw that Bradley tank, I've been in a Bradley tank. I know what they can do. Those are Americans. That's at a church site. And they're running over their automobiles because they won't give up their arms and come out.
And what did you do to these people?
you deprived them of life, liberty, and property. You didn't guarantee those rights, you deprived them of them.
This is McVeigh in his interview from prison with 60 Minutes.
The thing that hits me the hardest about that is the CS gas. Just knowing what it does, and knowing as some adults can barely breathe because of it. When I saw it introduced into a building full of kids like that, the emotions it brings up make me speechless.
There are a lot of people who are upset by that, who would say, yeah, what happened there is wrong, but those are isolated incidents. What would you say to them?
I would say I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I think for people that follow the news and follow events, there are patterns of abuse evident.
Waco was the trigger for his planning the Oklahoma City bombing.
Gerilyn Merritt, another member of McVeigh's defense team.
He was just devastated when he found out that the children had died there. He viewed that as extremely tyrannical and a sign that citizens of this country needed to arm themselves to protect themselves against government soldiers who will come in and shoot citizens and children who hadn't committed any crime.
What really upset McVeigh were the dead children at Waco. Merritt remembers that even after the Oklahoma City bombing, McVeigh would focus his rage by watching one particular video.
And he would play this tape over and over again of these children dancing in a circle and singing a song and saying, he would almost be crying about how angry he was at the government. And these were not children at Waco, by the way. This was like a news tape in which it included a circle of children dancing.
This, of course, is pretty rich for a man who single-handedly murdered 15 innocent children at the America's Kids Daycare Center in the Murrah Building. McVeigh told Jones that in Waco, the federal government had, quote, set the rules of engagement, and that more children were killed in Waco than in the bombing. To put it another way, McVeigh told Jones, the kill ratio of child to adult victims was 1-5 in Waco, whereas in Oklahoma City, it was 1-10. Throughout the 2 years before the bombing, McVeigh talked about Waco endlessly. He ordered videotapes, books, and magazines about the siege. McVeigh absorbed all of them and sent them to others. He wrote to a friend that Waco was, quote,
that event which in my mind is the straw that broke the back of Lady Liberty and drew first blood of war, no longer of peacetime. Waco.
As 1994 began, McVeigh was still drifting across the country attending gun shows. He would frequently visit with Nichols, using the farm in Michigan as his mail drop.
That's the only way they can trace me.
McVeigh prepared for a life completely underground.
And I stepped back in my military training. You can't win the game if you're always on the defensive, because that naturally means the other team always has the ball. They're on the offensive. You'll never put points on the board being on the defensive.
McVeigh still had football on his mind, and something unprecedented happened to his team.
Super Bowl 28 ended tonight in Atlanta as a football tragic comedy, with the Dallas Cowboys rallying to beat the Buffalo Bills 30-13.
In January 1994, McVeigh watched as his Buffalo Bills became the only American professional team in any sport to lose a championship 4 straight times. Still seething about the Bills and Waco, McVeigh watched the news, and he became even more paranoid that the government was coming to take his guns.
It's amazing to me that we even have to have this debate. I mean, how long are we going to let this go on?
On September 13th, 1994, President Clinton signed the federal assault weapons ban.
Victims killed with deadly assault weapons. Bill Clinton did something no president has ever been able to accomplish. He passed and signed a tough law to ban deadly assault weapons.
For McVeigh, this was the Turner Diaries coming true. In the novel, the Cohen Act banned private ownership of guns, starting a systematic oppression of white gun owners. He thought the new Democratic president was following the same script. McVeigh told Stephen Jones that the assault weapons ban was the last straw. In the late summer of 1994, the bombing conspiracy officially began. McVeigh moved in with Terry Nichols, who had brought his small family to Marion, Kansas. McVeigh was now on a full-time mission to go on the offensive against the federal government. In that remote part of the country, the two men started training as if they were going into battle. On September 30th, 1994, just days after Clinton signed the assault weapons ban, Terry Nichols used a fake name to purchase 40 50-pound bags of fertilizer, bomb ingredients.
And they obviously knew there were these kinds of resources there. And buying large amounts of ammonium nitrate out in the middle of nowhere may not and did not cause attention, whereas it might have if they had done it in a major urban area.
Next time on Homegrown, McVeigh prepares his attack.
I mean, he at one point says to McVeigh, well, you're going to kill a lot of people here and not just agents. I mean, what about like secretaries? And McVeigh analogizes to stormtroopers in Star Wars. He said the individual stormtroopers may or may not be bad people, but they serve, you know, an evil empire. So, you know, they're collateral damage.
Homegrown Oklahoma City is a USG audio podcast produced by Western Sound in association with Esmail Corp. It's reported, written, and hosted by me, Jeffrey Toobin. Executive producers are Josh Block at USG Audio, Sam Esmail and Chad Hamilton at Esmail Corp., and Western Sound's Ben Adair and Colin McNulty, who is also the editor. Production support from Josh LaLonghi at USG Audio. The producer and sound designer is Tyler Hill. The associate producer is Stella Hartman. The producer from Esmail Corp. is Sarah Maddy. Original theme and engineering by Alex McGinnis. Fact-checking by Nicole McNulty and Savannah Wright. Special thanks to Betsy Shepard and Dan Leone. Passages of Timothy McVeigh are read by Chris Cowan. Our gratitude also to the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum and to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. For more information on this podcast and other podcasts from USG Audio, go to our website, usgaudio.com. And to learn even more, read my book, Homegrown: Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism.